welcome to Comic Talk Today for Monday, August 20th, 2018. And this is the Top of the Pile. Of course, every week on Top of the Pile, I talk about some of my favorite books in this past week. And this week, just like last week, I've got a book that maybe wasn't my favorite, but I found really intriguing. On the docket for today, I have one Aftershock, one Dark Horse, one Image, two Marvel, three DC. And as usual, I'll go in that order. So from Aftershock Comics, I've got Volition number 1. This is written by Ryan Parrott with art by Omar Francia, letters by Marshall Dillon. And this is a sci-fi futuristic story about a world in which robots have achieved independence, I guess you could say. It's a little bit Blade Runner, and it is beautiful to look at. Beautiful to look at. In many ways, it reminds me of reading the latest iteration of Rye from Valiant. Although in that you have the digital painting art style of Clayton Crane. This is not digitally painted. I do believe that the coloring must be done in a similar way, but I'm pretty sure this is pencils and not actual digital painting. It is beautiful to look at, seriously. If you look at some of the preview pages, you will be hopefully astounded by what you look at. I think it's a beautiful book. In fact, as you dive deeper and deeper into the book, I think it gets even more and more brilliant in the way that the art is done. Because at first you get kind of a glimpse of what this world is about. And basically, to give you a short recap of the story, at one point in the not too distant future, about 150 years into the future, 120 years into the future, there is a scientist who figures out how to create artificial intelligence properly. And as those of you that listen regularly know, I'm a huge fan of tech. I love all this stuff. I love this field. And AI is something that I'm very interested in, and I follow very closely. And we do have, you know, some kind of AI right now, but it's not quite like the AI that we have in this world, because this is definitely much more advanced, right? The AI we have now is kind of more programmed by humans, whereas this, it's almost like you could just give a robot some kind of identity, and they would develop their own intelligence built on top of that. We do have a little bit of that now. There's the machine that can play Go against humans. That's freaking, it's brilliant. Matter of fact, there's a documentary on it. I want to say it's just called Go, but there's a documentary about the creation of that AI, and I recommend everyone watch it. Back to Volition, though. This is a really interesting world. So we have this artificial intelligence that's created, and robots are, of course, like always, made to kind of serve mankind. But because they are intelligent, they decide that they want their own rights. And so the story takes place many years after after robots gain their independence. Now, they still live in the U.S., and I'm assuming around the world, although the story centers in America. And they do still live here, but they're basically independent of humanity, right? They have basic robot rights. They earn a living just like humanity does. And one thing that I talked about in the Aftershocks of Your podcast when we talked about this last week, I'm very curious to know how it is that humanity lives in this world, because that's one thing that's not discussed in this issue. I'm sure that it'll be discussed later on, but it's definitely not discussed in this issue. And, you know, the only bits of humanity that we see, people aren't very nice, right? So we see, for example, people going up, revolting against robots, holding marches and protests, saying like, "Hey, you know, we don't want you here." Blah blah blah. That's a theme in this episode apparently, because that'll also come up when I talk about a Marvel book later on. But really interesting stuff. And of course, the robots, the one difference between robots and humanity is that robots can be upgraded, but just like in our world now, those things aren't cheap, and so sometimes robots can't afford to upgrade themselves to serve their job best. So they will be replaced by a better model. And so those robots tend to resort to a life of crime, and much of this issue deals with a gang of criminals that try to steal some of these upgrades for themselves. There's also a separate story which follows Amber, who is what the first robot that's introduced in this issue. And after being quote-unquote born, and I know Ryan tweeted out a little bit about this, there's born robots and there's bred robots. So born robots are robots that are created by humanity and implanted with this AI. And then you have bred robots that are created from parts of two other robots with kind of a mesh of both of those robots' personalities, I guess, fused together into one. So this is the way that robots can have children, right? Because obviously they don't have the biological equipment to create a new entity, but really interesting stuff that that this issue plays with. One of the main problems with this world is that as a result of all these upgrades that robots constantly try to do for themselves, there's a computer virus that arises called Rust. And Rust kind of makes robots go a little crazy, and there may be a certain point to what Rust is, and I think that's kind of played around with a little bit here. Now, I don't know if Rust is created to kind of put robots back under the power of humanity. That's very possible. But it's also possible that the original creator of this AI created Rust or somehow implanted Rust into these robots to make them see the world differently. And they definitely do. In some ways, it reminds me of like a little bit like a schizophrenia, maybe. There's a little bit of like Alzheimer's in there. But whenever a robot is afflicted by Rust, they start talking in code. And we see that in one of the robots towards the latter end of the book in the robot hospital. And that leads into some other things that will definitely set up the future issues of the series going forward. But I gotta say, this issue was really enthralling and something that's very different from what we normally see in comics. And I love seeing that kind of stuff. And I love sci-fi, so the more the merrier. But I think this is something that really hasn't been tackled very well in comic books, although we see it a lot in sci-fi novels. And so I'm very happy that this book is out. That is Volition number 1 from Aftershock Comics. I really enjoyed this book. I cannot wait to read the rest of the miniseries, and I hope that there's enough room in here and that the book is popular enough where we'll get a second volume, because I think the world is rich enough where this could be something that can be explored in future volumes. If you did not pick it up, I recommend you do. In fact, your shop has nothing to lose, because as I talked about last week on the news segment, Aftershock is now doing a full refunds on all number ones and some number two issues for retailers. So if your shop is not carrying Aftershock books, go ahead and tell them, hey, you've got nothing to lose. You can return the books within 30 days if they don't sell or whatever, if your clientele doesn't like them. So think about that. Talk to your shop. All they got to do is order 5 books, and then they become eligible for refund. I'm going to rate Volition number 1 a 4 out of 5. I thought it was brilliant. Really great book. If I go over to Dark Horse, I'm going to be talking about the Terminator Sector War number 1. This is written by Brian Wood. We've got art by Jeff Stokely, colors by Triona Farrell, letters by Net Picos. And this is actually really interesting. I love Terminator stuff. In fact, there's those franchises that had movies in the 80s I really love, right? So like the Aliens franchise, the Predator franchise, the Terminator franchise. And Dark Horse has had the license for all of those for many, many years. My assumption is that may end up changing with the whole Fox-Disney merger, because if I'm not mistaken, Disney will own the Alien franchise. I'm not sure about the other two, but definitely Alien. So that may be changing at some point in the future. However, I will say that Dark Horse has done a fantastic job with all of these properties over the years. So I hope that they can just stick with it and keep it going. And that may be part of the reason why we have a new Terminator book out. Because the difference with this Terminator Sector War series is that while it is still in continuity, in fact, it does take place in 1984 at the same time as the original Terminator film, it does not have anything to do with Sarah Connor. At least not that we know of. It actually follows a NYPD officer named Lucy Castro, and she is being targeted for assassination. Now, we don't know a whole lot yet, right? This is very much a setup issue. As far as I understand, Lucy Castro is a brand new character. I don't remember ever seeing her in anything else. I could be wrong about that. So if you're a fan of the franchise, let me know. Terminator comics are not ones that I read very often. I'm more of a Predator guy. I have read all of those. But I'm very curious. So if you follow these comics, then let me know. But it's very much kind of like the original Sarah Connor story. So if you've never seen Terminator for whatever reason, number one, why are you listening to this podcast? Go watch Terminator and the even better Terminator 2. You can skip the rest of them. But Arnold Schwarzenegger's character, the Terminator, the T-800, he is sent back to the past from the future. And in the future, there's a war between humanity and robots because here we go with the AI thing. An AI has decided that humanity is not worth saving. So Arnold Schwarzenegger's character is sent back to the past, the T-800, and his job is to kill Sarah Connor because her son, John Connor, is going to be the leader of the resistance. Now, like I said before, this has nothing to do with that, although it takes place in the same year. And it does seem like there are some similarities to the story as what we see in Terminator, because Lucy Castro is, I mean, she's an NYPD officer, so she's a little more skilled in terms of dealing with the criminal aspect than Sarah Connor was in that original film, right? Even though she becomes a badass in the end, she has no expertise with weaponry or anything, so there is somebody that's sent back to help her. Now, there's nobody here sent back to help Lucy. All we have is another T-800 model that's sent back in order to kill Lucy. And that's all we know. We also know that Lucy is pregnant. Her boyfriend is a piece of trash, pretty much, actually, in this issue. She is kicking him out of the house because he just hangs out at home, cheats on her all day, and eats cookies, and I guess smokes pot? I don't know. That's the way it seems. But she kicks him out. And this is when the T-800 shows up. And basically the issue follows Lucy as she's trying to get away from this T-800 robot. A pretty straightforward story. Like I said, it seems like she may be pregnant, so that may be the connection to the future that we see in the Terminator films. But, overall, I really enjoyed it. And I gotta say, I love Brian Wood's style of writing. And of course, I'm reading some of the other stuff like Sword Daughter I've talked about before. I think it's a brilliant book. I'd recommend you go ahead and read that if you're not picking that up. But yeah, this was really fun. And I'm very curious to see how much they're going to change of the Terminator mythology just on this series alone. Because my assumption is that Lucy must play some kind of important role in the future. The art is fantastic, so I recommend you check it out. It's got it's a little bit manga inspired, I would say, but don't let that put you off if you're not a fan of that art style, because it's not quite, I don't even know, maybe, you know what? Manga style is definitely not the way to do it. That's not fair. I don't think it's that at all. Let me take that back. This is not manga inspired, although I do see hints of it. It's just, it's really well done. I thoroughly enjoy Terminator Sector War number 1. I'm definitely in on this. It's a 4-issue miniseries, and like I said, I love the franchise. So if you like these kind of books, if you're a Brian Wood fan, then I recommend you check this out. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5 as well. On to Excrement number 6 from Image Comics. This was almost at the top of my list. So I'm going to head and give the rating out of the way. This is going to be a 5 out of 5. Ice Cream Man is one of those books that is just absolutely brilliant every single issue. And I know not a lot of people read this. I think the people that read it definitely enjoy it. But highly recommend you check this out. It's written by Maxwell Prince and art by Martin Morazzo. Colors by Chris O'Halloran and letters by good old Neon. Good old Neon! But if you've never read Ice Cream Man before, it's kind of a horror story. There is a central character that is a tying theme through many of the vignettes that we get through each issue. Most of the issues are self-contained, although there are recurring characters throughout these issues. And there is kind of an overarching story, and the overarching story is really told in how these characters connect to the Ice Cream Man. And we don't really know who the Ice Cream Man is, what he's about. Based on one of the previous issues, I think it was issue 3 or 4, it looks like he may be either God or a devil or a similar entity, but not really described in any way. And I don't think that's been touched upon since that came out. But like I said, most of the issues are self-contained. So you can definitely pick any issue up and kind of get a feel for what this is about. In fact, when you go to your comic shop this week to pick up your new books, I recommend you go ahead and do that. If they have a copy of Ice Cream Man, check it out. I think you might enjoy it. This may be one that may not be the best issue for a first-time reader of Ice Cream Man. And the reason for that is this is almost entirely a silent issue. Now, I know many of you that like to read comics don't like to read silent issues. And I put read in quotes because there's no words, so there's really nothing to read. But this issue really has maybe 5 or 6 words in the entire book. There's a shh in the first panel, and then you have like a 4-word sentence in the very last page. And that's about it. But the entire story is silent. And the reason I want to put this book on my top of the pile this week is because I think it really speaks a lot to what can make comic books really a great medium for storytelling. Again, I'm sure many of you just like to read the typical Capes and Cow stuff or the comic Veritas stuff, the slice of life, as some people say, and that's fine. And in some ways, this book is kind of a comic Veritas book with some horror themes in it. And this issue is called Neapolitan, is the title of the particular issue, and that is actually key. And this kind of goes with what I'm trying to say about comics can be so much more than many people make them out to be, right? Because I think even us as comic readers, we often think of it as kind of a more entertaining medium. And there are very few writers and artists that really try to do innovative things with the books that they're doing. And I think this week, most of all, I mean, I've read a lot of comics this week. I think I've read 26 books this week. I'm not, obviously not talking about all 26, but I felt like for some reason this week out of all the weeks, and maybe it's just something that I noticed, seemed like the creators involved with those books were trying to do much more varied things, trying to play with the medium a lot more. Obviously I talk about Volition a little bit and I think it does that quite a bit, in particular with the art. Some of the other ones that I'll be talking about later on in this episode definitely play with the art form quite a bit. In fact, my book of the week does that quite a bit, and we'll get to that in a second. But the issue is called Neapolitan, and for those of you that know your ice cream, by the way, Neapolitan is the ice cream man's favorite ice cream. Neapolitan ice cream has three different flavors. So you've got the vanilla, you've got chocolate, and you got strawberry. So it's three different colored ice cream. And what's really cool about the story is because that is the title of the issue, this book, this issue, follows three different potential storylines. And when I say potential, I mean they all start off with the same exact setting, right? So it's set in the present. There's a guy that buys ice cream from the ice cream man. And then as he leaves and he's enjoying his ice cream, the story splits into three different parts. All three parts happen at the same time, just in different realities. And so you get to see all three stories unfold throughout the issue through the eyes of the different flavor of ice cream. So on the page, you would have, so you have like the reddish pinkish on the top. You've got the whitish yellowish in the middle, and you have like a brownish story on the bottom, right? Representing all three colors of the Neapolitan ice cream. And what's really cool about it is it follows this guy in and kind of talks about how making certain life choices can really change the way you live your life on a daily basis. And really that's a central theme of Ice Cream Man. I think it's been that way pretty much every single issue, right? Everyone is always, their life changes quite a bit when they meet the Ice Cream Man, right? And I know earlier I said something about we don't know if it's God or the devil. And, you know, the way I described this, maybe it seemed more like he's the devil. But I gotta say, that may not necessarily be the case. And I think that's one cool thing about this is that it plays a lot with the sort of gray area of morality, right? Because you would think if everybody that meets this guy ends up having such bad things happen to them, maybe he is the devil. But at the same time, like, if he's not the devil, what if he's God? And kind of seeing how it is that we as humans live on a day-to-day basis, making our own choices out of free will, which we, of course, believe we have. So the issue plays a lot with that, right? So it's kind of this brings the story back, right? So even though they're all single-issue vignettes, the first arc ended with issue 5. This is the beginning of a new arc, and so it's really recapping basically the way the book works without actually recapping any of that previous story. And there are some characters from previous stories that do pop in into this issue, but overall it centers around this one guy. And based on the choices he makes, the story changes. So in one, he meets a woman, and they end up getting married, and they have a kid, and the kid gets sick, the kid dies, the wife becomes an alcoholic, and then maybe the guy becomes an alcoholic, and she kind of goes a little crazy. Pretty sad story. In another story, he's walking through the same park where he meets his wife in the first story, and his dog gets lost, and then he has to find the dog, and then he and the dog decide that they're going to move out to the country, and he pretty much leaves everything behind, and he lives the rest of his life seemingly very happy with just him and his dog. But think about the sacrifices he made, right? He never met this woman, never experienced love, never experienced having a child. But at the same time, he also didn't experience the death of his child, didn't experience the slow descent of his wife's mental state. But he definitely lived a happy life alone, just him and his dog, but lived a happy life. And in the other one, he kind of takes a wrong turn on the way home and ends up being kidnapped by supposedly a serial killer. A guy in a bird mask, and he is physically abused. He has a knife stabbed through his leg. He's kind of left in this room just bleeding out, and bad things happen to him. He probably dies as a result of it. Really interesting stuff, and I think I don't want to talk too much more about it because there's not a lot to say with an issue that has no words, really. But think about when you read comics, what you plan to get out of these comics and how much more you can get out of it if you read the right things, right? So oftentimes when I talk about books, in particular on Twitter, I've noticed, I get a lot of comments like, oh man, this sounds freaking awesome. I love to read it, but you know, my budget is very low and I'm just sticking with Spider-Man and Batman. Okay. And I totally understand that kind of thing. But those of us that love reading comics, we should always try to experience the medium even more than we already do. And that's part of the reason why I read so many comics. And of course, there are people that read much more than I do. I think those people are probably much fewer than I think. But there's definitely people that read a ton of books. For example, Mike Myers over at Mike Ebbs Weekly Reads, I mean, he gets like 100 books a week, right? I mean, I could not find the time to read 100 books a week. I don't even know if he has time to read 100 books a week. But the thing is, he loves comics and he wants to experience it all. And I want to experience as much as I can. And I think many of you listening to this do as well. So definitely check out Ice Cream Man if you're one of those people. If you want to try something new in comics, if you want to see what the medium can do, I think Ice Cream Man is probably one of the best places to start on that. By the way, I just want to point out, I know I've recommended Red Hood and the Outlaws quite a bit. I've received a ton of messages, both publicly and privately, from people that listen to the podcast that picked up either a single issue or three or four or five issues of Red Hood and the Outlaws and absolutely loved it, and they're going back and picking up the whole series. If you're one of those people, I want to hear about it, but I'm really happy to hear that kind of stuff. I'm happy that the podcast is making at least a little bit of impact on some of you. So thank you all for the comments. Let's move over to Marvel Comics and talk about The Edge of Spider-Geddon, number one. This is written by Jed McKay, pencils by Gerardo Sandoval, colors by the amazing Brian Reber. He's the best. Letters by Corey Pettit, and this is really fun. This is kind of the prelude to the Spider-Geddon event that is going to be going on. Of course, it seems like it's going to be the follow-up to Spider-Verse. Matter of fact, Nick and I did an episode, a book club episode of the Nerd Legion podcast, I want to say last year, and we talked about the Spider-Verse event, and we both really enjoyed it. And one thing that I always do, even if I don't constantly read a Spider-Man book, although I am reading the current one, as some of you may remember, even if I don't always read the Spider-Man books, I always pick up the event books because I think the event books have been really fantastic over the last few years. And this one is gearing up to be something that I think I'll really enjoy as well. Because in particular, if it's a follow-up to Spider-Verse and it is one of my favorite Spider-Man events ever, I'm definitely all in on this. So Edge of Spider-Geddon is going to be a four-issue miniseries, if I'm not mistaken. There's going to be four issues of this. There's going to be a zero issue of Spider-Geddon. And then we have the launch of the Superior Octopus, which looks amazing as well. And then we're going to get the actual Spider-Geddon event. These four issues in the miniseries are all self-contained. So this first one focuses on the Spider-Punk. And he's from Earth 138. It's like the anarchist Earth. And I'm looking forward to the next issue. Issue 2 deals with Spider, and that's going to be written by friends of the show, Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler. So I'm very excited for that because I love those guys. I love everything they do, and I'm happy to see them working on a book for Marvel in the Spider-Verse universe. This series will actually end up serving for is kind of a recap of who the central characters are, right? So we have Spider-Punk, next one's Spider. I can't remember what the issue 3 and 4 are, but it's going to deal with some of the central characters of the Spider-Geddon storyline. And I really enjoy this one. It's very quirky. But I got to say, this Gerardo Sandoval, he is a fantastic artist for Spider-Man. His style is so kinetic, so vibrant, so fluid. It was just incredible to see what he can do with Spider-Man. I would love to see this guy on the main Spider-Man book. And I know that Ryan Otley's doing Amazing Spider-Man right now with Nick Spencer. But man, oh man, like this guy, He might have Otley beat. I hope Otley doesn't listen to this podcast. He might get mad. But man, I thought it was fantastic art on the issue, and I love this world. Everything is kind of punked out. And one thing that I really liked about it is that Kang the Conqueror makes an appearance here. And of course, those of you that listen regularly may know I'm a huge fan of Kang the Conqueror. I'm slowly trying to get all his appearances throughout the years. And I loved it. And this is Kang the Conglomerator. And he comes from the year 2099, which, of course, for me, hits a soft spot because I remember reading all the 2099 books when they're coming out. When was that? Early 90s, mid 90s? You had Spider-Man 2099, which is still going on. There was a Doom 2099. There was a not very good X-Men 2099. There was a Ghost Rider 2099, Punisher 2099. Ah, man, I think there were a few more. I can't remember. Anyway, so he comes from that world. In the year 2099, he runs Kencorp. And what they do is basically it's a media conglomerate. And he owns the exclusive rights to the image of Spider-Punk. And so he has traveled to the past to kidnap Spider-Punk, take him to the future, in order to make even more money for himself and his company, because now they don't just have cartoons and toys and stuff. They have the actual Spider-Punk. And of course, Spider-Punk he's a punk. He's into anarchy and he doesn't want the man to be after him. He doesn't want to be part of capitalism. And so he definitely goes up against Kong and tries to defeat him, along with the aid of Captain Anarchy, who is this world's version of Captain America. Remember, this is a punk universe, so everything's anti-establishment. There's also a punk Hulk that I really enjoyed seeing here, and we do get to see a Spider-Woman show up, which I can't remember which Spider-Woman that is. I want to say it's Mayday Parker, Peter's daughter from another universe. But I may be wrong on that. Pretty sure. If you're a fan of this world and you remember, let me know and correct me. But I'm pretty sure it's Mayday Parker. Anyway, so Spider-Punk and Spider-Hulk and Captain Anarchy go up against Kang the Conglomerator, end up defeating him in the end. And I love that Kang the Conglomerator has an army of little like chibi Spider-Punk toys that are like little robots. He has an army of them that he uses to fight Spider-Punk. I thought it was brilliant. And, yeah, I really enjoyed this. It is nonstop from beginning to end. The writing style works really well. You know, when you're writing a Spider-Man character, you need to have that humor, but you don't want to overdo it, I think. And, I think that's one thing that sets the Spider-Man books apart from some of the other stuff that tries to be a little funny like Deadpool. And, it worked really well. I thoroughly enjoy this, and, I can't wait to read the next issue of the series. And of course, can't wait for Spider-Geddon to get here, because I'm very excited for this. Overall, I'm going to give this one also a 4 out of 5. Next up, I want to talk about my almost pick of the week. I mean, this book was pick of the week from the day. This is the first book I read this week. I read it on Wednesday, like, I don't know, around lunchtime. So like noon. And I read it and I immediately said to myself, this is freaking awesome. This is my book of the week. And Saturday, I was reading the rest of my pull list. I reread this book and I was like, you know what? This is still my pick of the week. And then ever since then, I reread a couple of the books that I was thinking about, this one being one of those, as well as the one that's actual pick of the week. We'll get to that later. And I was like, oh man, it is very, very close, but I cannot make Extermination number one pick of the week. I will make it this other one. Some of you will be really surprised. Some of you may already see where this is going, but we'll get to that. We'll get to that. Extermination number one, this is, of course, a new summer event for the X-Men franchise, and it's basically Marvel's attempt at cleaning up the X-Men universe, which I gotta tell you, I'm very good with. I think the one thing about the X-Men is because there's so many characters, so many storylines, oftentimes so many books, so many different creators working on these books, things can get a little out of hand sometimes. And of course, now that Disney is going to have the rights to the X-Men again, it makes perfect sense that Marvel will want to make the X-Men a central thing as well. And, you know, we're going to be getting the relaunch of Uncanny pretty soon. I talked about that last week. There's three writers, three artists. It's weekly, at least for the first 10 issues. And that'll be very exciting. But between now and then, we need to clean some of this stuff up. And, you know, Brian Michael Bendis, he brought in the original X-Men from the 60s into the future. And they've kind of been the lead cast of the X-Men Blue title over the last, I don't know, how long now? Year and a half, 2 years? And I love the book, but you know, if they need to kind of make things a little more cohesive if they're going to try to bring Uncanny back and bring back some of that original excitement that I don't think we've really seen in quite a while. You know, I loved reading the X-Men in the, well, I mean, I started in the early 90s, but I went back and read the 80s stuff. The Claremont stuff is still some of my favorite, of course, partially because he dealt so well with Emma Frost. And I know some of you are thinking, well, he he wrote Emma Frost because he was into S&M, and that may be true, but you know what? I don't care, because Emma's the best. And anyway, so this is written by Ed Brisson, with art by Pepe Larraz, colors by Mark Gracia, and letters by Joe Sabino. And I really enjoy this book. It, of course, centers on those original five X-Men from the X-Men Blue title, and along with Bloodstorm, who, if I remember correctly, she popped in and out of X-Men Blue. And Bloodstorm, for those of you that don't know, is also kind of one of these universe-displaced, time-displaced versions of Storm, except she's a vampire and not just Storm. Whatever. Spoiler alert, there are some characters that die in this issue. Do I want to say who dies in this issue? There are two characters that die in this issue. I'm not going to say who it is. I think by now, if you wanted to read this, you probably read it already. But there are some of you that still do DCBS and some of the other ones, so maybe you haven't read this yet, and I don't want to spoil it for you. But there are two characters that die. Definitely one. The other one I'm not quite sure about yet. And it's really interesting. It kicks off 20 years in the future, and we've got a mysterious hooded character is this a spoiler too? Alright, this is the only thing I'm going to spoil about this. Immediately when I saw him, I said, okay, this is Cable. And as we get into the story, we learn that maybe it's not Cable. But then at the end of the story, we learn that it is Cable, except not our Cable. It's a different Cable from a different timeline, or maybe a different alternate reality, or I don't know. He's just a different Cable. And, man, does that mean the three characters die in this story? Man, that's tough. All right. You need to read this book, because there's just too many spoilers. There's a lot of people dying in here, a lot of weird stuff going on, but it works really well. And I got to say, the Pepe Larraz art is brilliant. I think one thing that every X-Men book needs to have, X-Men is like one of those tent poles for the Marvel Universe, right? I mean, if I had to pick some tent poles, it would be, so I guess we could do, let's do titles. So you'd have to have Uncanny X-Men, which that's coming back, that's a tent pole. You have to have the Fantastic Four, that just came back, that's a tent pole. You have to have an Avengers book, I mean, that's always been around. And I guess, I mean, the fourth tentpole would be a Spider-Man book, which just relaunched. So those are the tentpoles. When a publisher as big as Marvel, or I mean, you can do it with DC or some of the other ones, but when you have these tentpole books, when you have these tentpole aspects of your comic book universe, right? Key books, key characters. You need to have your best creators on those books. And I'm not saying that the creators currently on any of the X-Men books are not good. In fact, friend of the show, Cullen Bunn's doing X-Men Blue, and I think he's doing a fantastic job. He's doing, some of the Magneto stuff that I really love that he played around with in the Magneto series he did. You have to have great writers. You have to have the best artists that you have on your roster. They need to be on these books because they're your tent poles. You cannot have giant books with kind of okay talent. And, I think for the most part, Marvel has done a really good job of cultivating new talent. You know, I talked about this a few weeks ago, how Marvel is doing a great job of bringing in a lot of indie talent. And, you know, they need to beef up the roster because for a while you weren't sure, right? Like, all the people were leaving to go and do their own indie stuff. And, there were very few people that people knew at Marvel, I would say. Now it seems like the bench is growing quite a bit, and I really like that. And Pepe Larraz has been with Marvel quite a while. He's done some really great work for him, and it makes perfect sense that he would be on this book because he is a fantastic artist. It is brilliant, brilliant. It is very well polished. It fits very well with kind of the art style that we're kind of used to seeing in the X-Men world, and it's very polished, and it needs to be, right? Because it's a tentpole book. So I love the art. I think one of the best things about this book is the art. The story is really interesting, by the way. So don't let me take away from that. But the art is fantastic. And the story is really well done too. You know, Iceman gets kidnapped by the mysterious hooded being that ends up being young Cable. And it really creates a sense of like, almost dread, you could say, right? Because you want to know like, what's going to happen to these characters, right? Because right now they are the X-Men in some way. But, and of course they are the original X-Men, but they're time displaced, right? And a lot of people still want what we had, right? They want our Cyclops, our Jean Grey, which just came back, right? You had the Phoenix Resurrection. You still got Beast there and stuff, but, you want to have this team come back together again. And Extermination really is a cleanup of all that. It's a cleanup of X-Men continuity over the last, I don't know, how long now? 10 years maybe? Maybe longer? Maybe not even that long. I don't know. I was out of X-Men for quite a while. I came back during IVX, and I've really enjoyed what I've seen. You know, and I think this is definitely, if you were a fan of the X-Men 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I think this might be the closest to that, that we've seen. There's some hints of like Days of Future Past here. In fact, one of the villains that shows up is Ahab from that storyline. And, so there's definitely some hints, some callbacks to that storyline. And I think that was a very popular storyline and it worked very well. So anyways, there's too much to talk about in Extermination. I thought it was brilliant. It was really well executed. The pacing's fantastic. Art is incredible. And, I'm looking forward to the rest of the series. I want to see how much we're actually exterminating. Will these characters disappear and maybe never come back? Are we still going to see some of these characters remain in the X-Men roster at some point? I don't know. They weren't in the teaser for Uncanny, so my assumption is no. But I'm definitely in for the ride on this one. Extermination number one, by the way, 5-issue miniseries, is going to be a 5 out of 5. Real quick, I want to talk about Pearl number one. This is also from DC Comics, part of the Jinx World imprint, which is, of course, Brian Michael Bendis's imprint. He is also the writer of this book, and the art is Michael Gatos, whom he co-created Jessica Jones with over at Marvel. So this is kind of their new thing. They're working in Jinx World together. They're going to be creating this book, maybe some other characters together as well. And letters by Josh Reed. And I thought this was really interesting. So on top of the pile, I normally only discuss my favorite books. But every so often, there comes a time where I read something that I find really interesting, but I can't quite make it one of my top books. But I still want to talk about it because I feel like there's enough interesting stuff in it where I feel like a lot of people will enjoy reading the book. And I think Pearl is one of those. Last week, it was Amazing Spider-Man number 3, which, even though I didn't rate it very highly, it kind of brought me back into wanting to read Amazing Spider-Man because I wasn't a fan of the first issue very much. But Pearl's really interesting. So, of course, it's the first book of the relaunched Jinx World. And, you know, Bendis did Jinx World before on a different publisher. And, matter of fact, was it at Marvel? It must have been at Marvel. It was an imprint over there. He's not doing it here. There's going to be several books coming out of the Jinx World imprint, some new, some old, that he's bringing in. Pearl is the first of those, and it basically centers around this. It seemed to me half Asian, half white, but I couldn't really tell. It's probably irrelevant, really. But she's a tattoo artist by day, kind of assassin by night, but we don't really see that. And I think the reason I want to talk about this is because I was very excited when I read about Pearl. The synopsis seemed interesting. The premise seemed interesting. It definitely deals with, like Yakuza and assassinations and all that stuff. And I love anything Japanese. There's something just about the culture that is really fascinating to me. And including the seedy underground element of it in the Yakuza. I really find that fascinating as well. And so I was very excited for this. And of course, she's a tattoo artist and I love tattoos. I've got a lot of tattoos. I've got, 14 tattoos. And, if you see me, you probably wouldn't be able to tell because I hide most of them pretty well. But, I do have quite a few. So I was excited. And of course, Michael Gatiss is doing the art. And I'll just start there. I think the art in this book is brilliant. There's some really interesting ways that Gatiss plays around with the art form. And again, that's kind of the theme for this episode, playing around with the art form of comics and making it something better, something more than just a fun superhero story. For example, when we have flashback scenes, the coloring is different in the book. Even the art style changes somewhat. So there's a flashback scene to Pearl having a discussion with her dad when she was 14. And he buys her an unregistered gun, I think with no serial number maybe. I can't remember exactly. But it's a clean gun. And the reason he buys her the gun is because he knows that she's now a teenager and she probably have sex with boys. And if they try to take advantage of her, she can shoot him in the you-know-what. And I thought that was really interesting, by the way, because I have two daughters, and one is 14 now. The other one just turned 8. And so, you know, it's not something that I think about all the time, but I do start wondering, you know, as they get a little bit older, how am I going to deal with boys and them? Because I know how I was when I was 14, 15, and I can only imagine nowadays. But the art style in that flashback is not only the coloring is very subdued, it's kind of bluish tints, but it's also much, in quotes I will say this, sloppier than what Gatiss usually does. It's very much, it's not like, alright, Michael Gatiss is a very talented artist. if I were to draw something, I would spend some time with it, make it look okay. Like, I'm an okay artist. But if I just want to do something, like a quick sketch, it would be like stick figures. Not Tom King stick figures, but stick figures nonetheless. That flashback scene is like Michael Gatiss' stick figures, I think, right? It's much looser, much rougher pencil strokes, but still beautiful to look at. And there's a lot of that, right? Like, there's one scene where Pearl meets this guy who actually knows what her tattoo is. We'll get to that in a second. And when these motorcycle, presumably Yakuza guys, show up, you see the whole scene changes, right? Even the panel layouts all change. It's all, like, separated by red lines because danger. And it very quickly conveys all that stuff, right? And I love that kind of thing. I love when the artist can really make an impact on what the storyteller is trying to say. And there's a lot in this book, and I think because of that, it does that very brilliantly. But the thing that failed for me a little bit was the storyline, because there's a lot of things that I think will go over a lot of people's heads. You know, for example, they're talking about the Irukugi, the tattoo that Pearl has on her wrist, and it's just a spider, right? But they make a big deal out of it, because this guy is also a tattoo artist. He knows what it means, and he knows how difficult it is to do this particular tattoo. And he wants to show, like, his friends, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's cool. It's a spider, right? Because they don't understand. And I think that's interesting, right? Because it's oftentimes how we maybe look at comics in a way as well, right? I mean, you can read a comic and just enjoy it for what it is, or hate it for what it is, whatever your particular cup of tea is. But there are some people, and I hope that I can be put in that segment, that oftentimes try to find what else is in these comics, right? And I think that works in particular more for certain writers, right? So somebody like Matt Cann or Jeff Lemire, those kind of guys, obviously Brian Michael Mendes, they often put little hidden things in here. And I think Matt Cann, for example, is an expert at that. If you've ever read Mind Management, like, you can't just read the story of Mind Management. You have to see what's in the edges of the borders, and there's oftentimes words or phrases, and those phrases are important to the story, sometimes the future issues of the story. There's a lot of work in telling that kind of story, right? Playing with the medium that much. And I like to look for those things. But not everybody can appreciate that, right? And I thought that was a nice touch in here. Maybe I'm reading it too much into it, but I do like to read into things a little bit more. In particular, when you have somebody like Bendis who, you know, when they announced that he was going over to DC, they're like, do we really want Bendis at DC? Like, Superman's just fine. And guess what? Now everybody was talking about is Superman in action, because they're brilliant, right? The stuff that we had before was great. The stuff we have now is fantastic. But, you know, some people didn't want to believe that kind of stuff. So I thought that was really interesting. The problem I have with the issue, though, is there's a lot of pieces in here, but we don't really know yet how those pieces are connected. I mean, we can make connections between all of those, right? There's quite a few central characters, three male characters, and of course Pearl, and those three male characters kind of represent different parts of Pearl's life. Both her own personal life and her professional life. And I think that's interesting. And I'm curious to know how that whole thing will play out in the end. But, I'm in for the ride. But again, I think even for a first issue, this left a lot to be desired for me. I wanted to see more of those connections off the bat. And we didn't really get that, right? It's definitely a slow burn. And I think that may be the point of it, right? I mean, Jessica Jones was kind of like that, but, yeah, you know, we'll see about Pearl. I'm definitely in for the ride, and I hope it does very well. But I think this may be one of those books where a lot of people end up not continuing on because of the way that the first issue is structured, but they may end up coming back in the end because so many things will happen with the storyline. So I'm going to go ahead and rate this one a 3 out of 5. It was good. The art is fantastic, but there were some things missing for me. So I have to rate it a little bit lower than the rest. On to a book that I always rate very highly, and I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this one because some of you may be tired of me talking about The Wildstorm. This is issue number 16, of course, written by Warren Ellis. We've got art by John Davis Hunt and letters by Brian Buccellato. I love saying his name. And letters by Simon Boland. And this is a great issue. You know, I always say this, and I hate to be a broken record, and that's why I'm not going to talk about this book too much, but I love how much Warren Ellis is changing from the characters in the original Wildstorm universe and making them new and fresh and refreshing. And this is another issue where we don't really concentrate too much on the Wildcats characters. Those were more key in the first arc or two. We've had a lot of focus recently on the Engineer. And of course, now we have Jenny Sparks. And I love that because, you know, the Authority and Planetary are some of my favorite things that Warren Ellis has done ever. And Jenny Sparks is key to that kind of stuff. The whole line of Sparks is kind of key to that. And there's been a few, right? It's like the spirit of the century kind of, right? And right now we're in a very tech connected internet age, and Jenny Sparks is that, right? And she kind of lives in the internet. She's not quite human, but not quite ethereal either. And it's played around a lot here. And I think the way that it's done, both in the written word and artistically, is really interesting because it's very hard to visualize what the internet looks like, right? But it's done so eloquently in this issue in just one panel, and I thought it was brilliant. And of course, there's a lot of setup here into how Jenny Sparks could help the Engineer in future storylines, because we still don't know if Marlowe and his team of Wildcats are actually the good guys or if they really just want to use the Engineer for her abilities. And she's got some really interesting ones, right? And we see a new one in this issue. She's actually talking to Grifter, and she creates a bullet out of her hand. And then she has Grifter take a gun apart, and so she can see how the gun works, so she can basically create a gun out of thin air because now she knows how it works. I think that would be my favorite superpower to have. Forget like flying and teleporting and all that. Just like to be able to do that kind of thing would be freaking awesome. Of course, on the sideline, we've got a separate storyline. There's a new character introduced. We had Lynch trying to, you know, go back and find the old Team 7 guys. You know, we talked about Backlash coming back and a few of the other ones. In this issue, we have Gloria Spaulding, and she is super creepy in here. And for those of you that remember Spaulding from the previous Wildstorm universe, when it was its own thing, Gloria Spaulding is the mother of Freefall, Roxy, from Gen 13. And she is creepy as hell. Matter of fact, there's one of the coolest panels in here. She's talking to Lynch, and Lynch is, of course, kind of trying to figure out where all the Gen 13 kids are. And Gloria's like, hey, like, you need to just get out of here. And I don't like what you're trying to do. And she starts like disintegrating the house because her ability has to do with gravity somewhat. So she's like disintegrating the house and bringing it up into the air. And then there's like a portal in the sky. She kind of makes all the pieces rain down onto Lynch's truck. Freaking awesome page. I loved it. Of course, I think things will be a little bit differently here. So in the original, Freefall is, Roxy is, Fairchild's half sister. Right? They have the same dad, Alex Fairchild. The thing that's different is in this universe, as we saw, I think 2 issues ago, Alex Fairchild is a woman, not a guy. So I guess maybe Roxy and Fairchild aren't related, but, still cool to see, Gloria pop in here. And I like how they're kind of interweaving some of the old story into this new story, kind of on the side of the main story as well. And, you know, this is 16 issues in. We have 9 more, I think it is, 8 more. You know, we're building up to something, and I want to know what that something is, right? Because while I'm really enjoying the ride all along, there's so many things going on here. And I know that he's working on a separate Wildcat series, a separate Zealot series, but I want to know how all these things will be connected and how that'll branch off once the story ends in issue 25. But I love the Wildstorm with every single issue. This is a fantastic issue as well. And you should be reading it. I mean, I say it every time. And the reason I say it is because I don't feel like enough people are reading the Wildstorm. And you really should. That's a 4 out of 5. All right. Let's talk about the final book of the week. This is the pick of the week. So, of course, it's a 5 out of 5. And some of you will be surprised. And some of you have already guessed that book is Batman 53 from DC Comics. This is, of course, written by Tom King. We've got art by Lee Weeks, and, of course, he's been on it for, I don't know, since issue 51, I guess. They're kind of like switching off arcs in the artists. And beautiful art, by the way. Beautiful art. I think, man, Lee Weeks, this man has been in comics for God knows how many decades, and I don't think he's ever drawn as beautifully as he is now. It is brilliant. I'm super happy that they brought him back from wherever he was to be working on comics full time again. It is awesome. This Batman book, when Lee Weeks is on it, it's just the most beautiful thing to look at. There's just something about the art style that I really, really love. And Lee Weeks, by the way, super nice guy. I met him at, Heroes Con? Might have been Heroes Con 2 years ago. Fantastic. Fantastic guy. Anyways, this, of course, is still part of the Cold Days story arc, in which Mr. Freeze has been put on trial for the death of some women around Gotham City. And Bruce Wayne kind of bribes himself into the jury. We do learn that here. I don't think that was mentioned previously in the arc. But he does bribe some people to get on the jury and try to get Mr. Freeze to go free. Because even though he's the one, as Batman, that arrested Freeze, he feels like maybe he missed some things. And Freeze may be innocent. Now, one thing that I didn't quite enjoy so much of the first 49 issues of Batman, Tom King's Batman, is that it felt off. And I'm not going to go in depth on this again because I've talked about it many, many times. And some of you may have even heard the episode in which I had Mike on, and Mike and I talked about why we hated this run. I know I've also had Daryl on, and we talked about why he loved it and why I thought he was wrong. You know, I've really turned around since issue 50. I thought 50 was great. And of course, 51 was brilliant and progressively better to 52, even better in 53. I think 53 is my favorite of those three, and I think it's great, you know? It's great for me as a Batman fan to be all in on a Batman book again, because while I hated those 49 issues, these last four have been really, really brilliant. To me, this is what a Batman book should be. And there's a reason for that. The reason for that is Batman felt off. And as we learn in issue 50, the reason why he may have felt off is because Bane was kind of moving things around in the background to make Bruce feel a certain way, and that way kind of made him not act the way that he should. And this story arc, this Cold Day story arc, has been kind of a build-up into him regaining his quote-unquote Batman-ness. It's not a word, but it's going to be in the dictionary next year, so start using it. Now, there is very little of Batman here. We do see Batman in a couple scenes. In fact, there's some fantastic panels in which we have some of the Batman rogues gallery. You know, like Joker shows up, Penguin, Two-Face, Freeze, of course, the Riddler, Scarecrow. And this is basically Bruce talking to the entire jury in the deliberation room. Although that's not really what the panels show, right? There are some panels of them actually talking in the deliberation room, but a lot of it follows kind of like what Freeze is doing. We see all these villains. We see Batman doing what Batman does around Gotham City while Bruce is talking, and that's kind of the narration throughout the issue. And basically he's trying to explain to the jury why it is that they should let Freeze be innocent. And the reason is, I thought very interesting, that he feels like he himself as Bruce, and really the majority of Gotham, see Batman as a god. And by seeing him as a god, they see him as infallible. Like, he can't do no wrong. But what he's trying to explain to them is that he's not a god. He's just a person in a Batman, in a bat suit. And because of that, he can make mistakes. And it is when those people can realize that he can make mistakes, that he's not, you know, the all-seeing protector, that he can never do anything wrong. Because of that, they should let Freeze go free. Because Batman made a mistake, and Bruce realizes that. Now, I think what worked really well in this issue is how much religion played a part in the argument. And the reason for that is I love religion stuff. I love religion. I don't go to church. I wouldn't consider myself a religious person. I do have certain spiritual beliefs. I have explored a lot of different philosophies, different religions from around the world. And I think there's definitely a little bit that can be taken out of all these different systems of belief to find kind of what the quote-unquote truth is. And the reason I love this issue is that it really centers on that discussion, right? Like, what is God? What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to look up to something and realize it's not the greatest thing? And I thought that was an interesting topic too, right? Because that's really been a central theme of this whole run, because, you know, while I never sent Tom King death threats, there are some idiots that have. And yes, I did call those people idiots because they are. Because let me tell you that no matter how much I hate something, I would never stoop to the level of sending somebody a death threat. It's a fucking comic book. Sorry for the profanity, but it's true. There is nothing in this world, well, there's very few things in this world that would have me hate somebody or hate a thing. I mean, I don't agree with our political situation. I don't hate any of those people. I think a lot of them are idiots, but the problem is they're in this system that has bred things to be the certain way. And that's kind of leeching into other things. And one of those things is comic books, which I love, and I hate that they leech into those things. But this definitely seems like a commentary by Tom King into that kind of thing, right? Like, nobody would ever want anybody but Bruce Wayne to be Batman. Nobody would want Batman to get married. Nobody would want Batman to quit being Batman. Everyone always wants things to kind of stay the same, stay a status quo. And that kind of doesn't allow writers to tell more interesting stories. It makes them tell the same story all the time. And that's not something that Tom King is doing. And I can appreciate that, right? And the commentary on that is brilliant, because that is the argument that Bruce is using to let Freeze go. Batman isn't perfect, right? He's not a god. Why should we hold him to that standard? We should think for ourselves and determine what is the best course of action. Just like when we read these comics, we should determine what is our favorite comics and why. And why do we hate? Why do we not like a book? Why do we not like where a story is going? Why do we not like a writer? Why do we feel like we have to defend a certain character or comic to the end and send people death threats? Why is that? There's not a reason for that. It's a comic book. And comic books aren't perfect because the people that write them aren't perfect. And God, I just thought about that, but that's so Grant Morrison. And maybe that's why I really like this so much. All right, so Grant Morrison's got this philosophy where, I've talked about this before, so if you've heard it, I apologize. But any chance I get to talk about Morrison, I will. Morrison's got this weird philosophy where we as readers read a comic book, right? But those comics actually are stories happening in a real place, okay? In a different reality, right? So, like, when you draw on a page, right, that's a two-dimensional drawing, we can see it on the page as a two-dimensional drawing, but we are three-dimensional, right? We have height, depth, and width. Well, maybe you could say fourth dimensional because we kind of flow through time. But then you also have beings, I can't remember what Morrison calls them, but there's like these alien beings. They tell stories to their kids about these characters, and those characters are us, they're humans. And I thought that whole thing was interesting in relation to the argument that Bruce makes in this storyline, because it's very similar in some ways, right? If we are to believe, and I think we should, based on the reaction to Tom King's run, that Tom is kind of putting some of that criticism into this story, then I think we could definitely believe that, right? Tom King isn't perfect. He's a guy, right? He's got a family. He's got a dog. He's got a job. His job is writing comics, but he's got a job, right? He's got to feed his family. He goes to the bathroom. He burns his eggs sometimes. He burns his bacon when he makes breakfast sometimes, I'm sure. Right? He's not a perfect guy. And so he may make some mistakes. But we shouldn't hold him against those mistakes. We should learn why those mistakes were made. And that's the story that Bruce is trying to tell here. And I thought it was so brilliant. And because of that, I had to make him a pick of the week. I mean, I've read this book four times. Each time I read it, I loved it more and more and more. I loved it from the first time. And that hasn't happened in a Batman book. The last four issues. But, God, it was so good. Brilliant stuff. I loved the commentary on the side and how that played into this issue. And, of course, this had one of my probably favorite final pages of any Batman issue. Because Bruce, as he's telling his argument, realizes, what is it about Batman that I need, right? Because now Catwoman broke my heart. I have to do things differently because I haven't been myself. And so he's talking to Alfred. We don't see Alfred. This is all happening while the jury's done deliberating and going out to the courtroom. But he's talking to Alfred. He's like, I'm going out. He's like, okay, I'll get your suit ready. He's like, yeah, not that suit. I need to use this other suit, because he's going back to the original bat suit, not the one that he's been using. Because the suit he's been using, he feels some kind of distance from. Right, because that's the Batman he was when he decided to marry Selina. And that's not the Batman he wants to be. And, I mean, this final page, I would kill to own this page. Lee Weeks, if you're listening, can I put it on layaway? Because I'm sure it's not cheap. But this page is beautiful. Beautiful. And there's only a few words on here. On the top, there's a little dialogue. Okay, word balloon. And it says, I need to remember who I am. And he's going back to the original suit. And then on the bottom, we've got a quote from Job chapter 1, verse 20 to 21. The reason for that is Bruce uses the story of Job to kind of explain to the jury his argument. And I'll go ahead and read the verses. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head. He fell down upon the ground and worshipped. He said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I love that quote, in particular to the relation to this issue, because Bruce is embracing what he has lost of himself. And, you know, he was trying to do his own thing, but that's not who he is. And now he needs to regain the personality that he has always lived with, right? We often talk about the fact, well, is Bruce Bruce, or is Bruce the personality that Batman uses? And this kind of really plays upon that, right? Because this whole time when he was trying to foster a relationship with Selina and onto the wedding, he had kind of lost his way a little bit. And now he's realized what it is that he needs to do. And what he needs to do is focus completely on being Batman and fixing what's wrong with Batman and what's wrong with himself. And I love that. I love that. It was a very emotional issue for me in many levels. I didn't cry. I don't often cry when I read my comics. It happens very, very seldomly. But I was pretty close. I was pretty close. It was very emotional. So, I mean, if I can say so many good things about Batman, if you are one of those people that haven't been reading this book, do yourself a favor and go back, starting with issue 51 and read on, because I think this is great sign of things to come. Of course, 5 out of 5. That is it for this episode of Comics of the Day. Thank you all for listening once again. I'm going to be launching a Patreon. You can already go check it out if you want. Patreon.com/NerdyLegion. That's been out there for a while. It's not officially launching yet, but if you want to go and support the show, then you can go ahead and sign up for that. There's no rewards or anything right now. It's just do you like the show? Then support it. At some point I will be doing all that stuff, but go check that out. If you feel like you want to send me a buck a month, that'd be awesome. What I really love is comments and feedback. So you can find me on Twitter, @Geekvine. There's been a lot of chatter about this show lately. I know I was talking to my ex-VCP co-host, Paul, and he was very pleasantly surprised by the amount of feedback on the show. So keep sending it. I would love to do another listener question. We haven't done that in a while. I'm actually going to be setting up a voicemail number. I'm going to give that out. I don't know if I'll be able to do it by tomorrow's episode, but sometime during this week, I'll be setting up a number where you can call and leave a voicemail. So if you want to do that, I will put your voicemail into the show. I think that'd be a fun way to interact with some of you. You can also email nerdylegion@gmail.com. That's going to be it for this episode. I will be back tomorrow with the news. I'll catch you then.